From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that is accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally. This morning, we talk with Terence Sainofsky. He's a leader in the recent convergence between neuroscience and AI. He talks about the mystery and possibility of AI consciousness in his new book, ChatGPT and the Future of AI, The Deep Language Revolution. Then we learn about ice patch archaeology and what is melting from the world's ice sheets with author Lisa Baril in her new book, The Age of Melt, what glaciers, ice mummies, and ancient artifacts teach us about climate change, culture, and a future without ice. Stay with us. We'll be back after these messages. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Neuroscientists and psychologists have studied human consciousness for decades, yet it remains the least understood aspect of human existence. As artificial intelligence systems like ChatGPT rapidly improve, how can we hope to understand if and when AIs become conscious if we don't understand our own consciousness? It is this and other mysteries that Terence Sainofsky, PhD, he's recipient of the 2024 Brain Prize, pioneer at the intersection of AI and neuroscience, Francis Crick Chair at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies, and distinguished professor at the University of San Diego, explores in his new book, ChatGPT and the Future of AI, The Deep Language Revolution. Terry, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, it's great to be here, Katie.
Let's start. Really, I think us humans take consciousness for granted because we just have it. Do you have a definition of consciousness?
I don't. And in fact, there is none. People argue about this. There are many, many definitions. And that's part of the reason why it's very difficult to study scientifically. If you can't define it, pin it down, and agree on what you're studying, you can't really make progress. Now, here's a problem, not just with consciousness, but with other words that we use like intelligence, understanding. These are words now that are being put forward to try to understand ChatGPT. Does it understand language? Is it intelligent? And, you know, there's huge arguments going on both sides. And it really comes down to this. They have different views of what intelligence is or consciousness. So if you look up the word consciousness in the dictionary, what do you get? You get a bunch more words. You look those words up, you get a bunch of words. It's all circular, right? You have to have some way of relating the word that you have so that that is more objective, that can be experimentally tested, and it has many meanings. That's the problem. Language is ambiguous.
So as you and your colleagues create more and more of these large language models and they seem to evolve on their own, are they developing their own consciousness? And does that keep you up at night?
First of all, I think things like intelligence and consciousness are not one thing. They're a spectrum. And all animals have some form of consciousness. Otherwise, they wouldn't survive. But it's different from ours. And so somewhere on that spectrum, GPT, and by the way, it's a moving target because, of course, as they get bigger and more capable, of course, you can say that, well, maybe the needle is moving up. They're getting closer to us. I don't think that they're anywhere near what we would call consciousness in humans.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Terry Sainofsky. He is an AI researcher and neuroscientist and distinguished professor at the University of California at San Diego. Terry, I'm wondering, as you're talking about consciousness, it's making me think about and wonder why our understanding of consciousness may help us along in how we understand AI.
Well, I think really what we want to do is understand how it is that ChatGPT talks to us. You know, it's as if an alien suddenly landed on the Earth and started talking to us in English. The only thing that we can be sure of is that it's not human, right? And really what we have here is a great scientific opportunity because, you know, linguists have been talking about language, you know, for a long, long time, and it hasn't really gotten really deep into what's called semantics. It's been focused on the surface, the syntax, the order the words are in. But really, language is all about meaning, semantics. And this is something now that we can study in ChatGPT. So I think that we have a great opportunity to really come up with a real theory of language because it's talking to us.
And so if we develop a theory of language, does that not just facilitate how we can come to use something like ChatGPT? Or is it meant to maybe help us quell our fear of the unknown with which AI, I mean, all of us have this fear. We don't know really what it is. We don't know how it's going to, you know, take over our lives, the world, et cetera. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, it's terra incognita. These are very early days. You know, we're talking, you know, we're a couple years in, but if you look at any other technological advance, it took decades. We're at the Wright Brothers stage. We just took off. Wright Brothers' first flight was 10 foot off the ground, 100 feet forward, and it took years and years to figure out how to control it safely. Same thing with these large language models. ChatGPT is in its infancy. Now, that having been said, we are really, I think, able to bootstrap ourselves here because I think scientifically, once we've figured out something about the nature of the semantic space that ChatGPT lives in, we should be able to relate that to the human brain. And that's what I study. And I think that that's where we're going to really make important discoveries about who we are and how our brain works.
Well, Terry, the idea of consciousness and the human interaction in the world also comes with it a set of moral values, good, bad, right and wrong. And is ChatGPT catching up to that, or is it just spewing what it thinks are the facts?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that ChatGPT doesn't have its own internal goals. You know, we have innate goals that, you know, nature gave us, you know, to survive, to reproduce. That's evolution. We haven't given those goals yet, and that's something that we'll have to really think hard about. Another thing to keep in mind is that when these large language models are trained, they're trained on an enormous amount of data. ChatGPT-4 took months of training, $100 million of computer time. $100 million, right? Huge amount of money. But, you know, at no point during the training was it given any what's called alignment. That is to say, any feedback about what's good and what's bad and what our cultural values are. And what we need to do is to treat them like children, right? Children come into the world. They don't know what language they're going to speak. They have no idea what culture they're going to be in. And of course, through interacting with their parents, with their peers, they learn those things. And that's what we have to provide for these large language models. We're just not doing it right now.
I was reading a couple of months ago that, and tell me if I'm wrong, that the ChatGPT and all of these models have actually burned through, if you will, everything that's available on the internet. All of the information that's available, it's already scraped, digested, and it's just waiting for more. What kind of problems will that create, if any? Will it just start feeding in on itself and possibly relearning incorrect information?
So you bring up something that is a very, very touchy topic. Okay, so you scrape the internet. What do you get? You get a lot of good information, you get a lot of bad information. Should you be surprised that ChatGPT has some bad things to say as well as good responses to you? What's happening actually over the last couple of months is a move away from just random data toward much higher quality curated data. And the companies are actually buying it because, you know, it's not free. And I have a friend, Stephen Wolfram, actually, who sold a lot of data about mathematics. He has a company called Mathematica, and he's selling his data, you know, to OpenAI, mathematical data. And that's high quality mathematical data. And that's going to really help raise the level, and already has raised the level of the language models. The other direction that the field is going is towards smaller models. The models have gotten humongous. They're like trillions of parameters. They're called weights. They're the connections between the units, like the synapses in our brain. And you need that many parameters in order to take in, you know, knowledge across the whole spectrum of humanity, of you know, novels, you know, all kinds of computer programs. I mean, you know, it's unbelievable how voracious it's been, and it can now help us with all of those. Write computer programs. It can help us write poems. It can help us write recommendation letters. I mean, you know, this is all being packed into one big model. But there's a lot of applications out there that don't need that much breadth. For example, you're a small enterprise company. You may have, I don't know, you may have a $1 billion cap, the capitalization. Now, you have all these records. They're in all over the place in different formats and so forth. And you need to look at them if you want to answer a question about, you know, what your total income is or what your projections are. Well, that takes a lot of people to look through all the records because it's very complex. Well, if you put all those records into a small language model, and that's all it knows, it just knows your company and nothing else. Well, maybe you put in some more things to explain, you know, how other companies work. But at that point, it becomes like an oracle. I don't mean the company. It will answer your questions immediately. You press the button, you get the answer. You don't have to wait a week.
Okay, well, this is all very interesting, this concept of curated data. So you take a company, like you use the example of Mathematica, and you know that that is good data. But good is, becomes pretty subjective in the world of the internet. And so how does that apply on a larger scale? I understand how smaller data sets it applies, but, you know, what about the big world of the internet?
So, you know, now we're getting into a problem that goes way beyond ChatGPT. We're talking about, you know, fake news. We're talking about conspiracy, and that's not a problem that is unique to ChatGPT. It's a problem that comes from us. ChatGPT is just a reflection of humanity, you know, with all its warts. we're blaming it. Really, we should be blaming ourselves and figuring out, okay, let me ask a question. Okay, you know, it's true that ChatGPT often has these biases. You know, there are famous cases where it can't recognize black faces as well as white because it wasn't given enough training examples of black faces. So not too surprising. But here's the question. Okay. Do you think it's going to be easier to fix the bias problem with large language models or humans? Is it going to be easier to fix us or these large language models? What's this going to be easier? I'd like to know what you think.
And it's definitely going to be easier to fix the large language models because we are the ones that are feeding it data. And if it's just looking at things subjectively, then we can start there. But building on this question, Terry, so the ChatGPT, the large language models have then been fed the correct information. It's been filtered through and we're getting actually the real facts. How can we then utilize that, or can we utilize that to then alter and change human perspectives and biases?
Ah, very interesting thought. And here's where I had a very interesting question. I give talks to large audiences, and I happen to be in China, and someone asked me the question, of all the applications, which is going to be the most important? And I thought about it for a while, and I realized that by far the biggest impact would be on education. You know, by far the best way for a child to learn something is with a one-on-one with a human tutor who understands that student and also is a good educator. Far, far, far better than a big classroom where the students are all over the place. Now, we can't afford that for every student, but if we can have a personalized ChatGPT tutor for every child, you know, and that would help, again, through the feedback, help them not just with, you know, learning knowledge or learning how to read or whatever. It would also help form them in terms of giving them feedback, these biased issues. And you know, that's something that would be, I think, fantastic because it could help children everywhere, not just here. It could help children in Africa, obviously with all these different languages and so forth. No, what a fantastic opportunity for us to be able to, as you say, to sort of erase a lot of the bad things we know that happen to humans, you know, that their brains absorb the wrong biases.
Well, I know there's an organization, CK12, and they already have, a Flexi chatbot, which is built specifically for AI tutoring. And it's amazing to see how they're able to feed it information so that kids around the world actually have a tutor right at their fingertips. So my follow-up question to this is, and I think Google started this, where we used to be curious and you'd come up with a question or ponder something and you'd maybe have to go explore the world or go to the library and dig through information. And with Google and these search engines, you just type it in and there's the answer. At least with that, you had to think of the right question. And with these new education models, with these ChatGPT education models, how much of our own innate ability to explore our curiosity are we losing when the answers are so quickly available?
So I guess the answer is probably, you know, technology changes. When's the last time you used a typewriter?
Not very often, but I still use a pencil and a sharpener.
Okay, very clunky. And, you know, and it's an obsolete technology. And, you know, I think that as we move forward, we have an interface now with computers that can be through language, which, you know, will be... The computer now will adapt to us rather than the other way around, right? And I think that's where things are going to go. That is to say, we're going to have personal assistance. We're going to have the ability. And you say, you know, that Google helped you think about the right words. That's really a crutch. And by the way, it doesn't always give you what you're looking for, right? You have to search. You still have to search through a bunch of places. What I've noticed now is that Google is actually, you know, even without, it gives you a bunch of sentences that you can look through, right? I mean, that's already telling you that this is a better way to get answers across is through sentences. It's not through links.
It's interesting. I'm thinking now of when you do a query in, you know, in Google, for example, you automatically get the AI answer that appears first. And it's usually, as you say, it's not full of links. It has more complete sentences and it's a little longer. How do you feel about that presentation for us and trusting it? Because as it has, it seems even in the last 6 months, it has really evolved to feeding us the AI answer, the machine learned answer. Do you, when you, Terry, Google something, do you trust that answer or do you go further?
I never trust any answer. I don't trust humans, actually, quite frankly. So, you know, even human experts gets things wrong. Human experts aren't necessarily omniscient, right? It's a matter of tracking it down. And this is something that students have to learn, or we have to learn, which is that if you get an answer, you really should track it down to confirm it. Because, you know, you could get a wrong answer or it could lose a name. And it, actually, even worse, it could be the humans can't agree on the answer, right? Even if you think it's right, somebody else will think it's wrong. So what do? ChatGPT is a tool. It's just a tool that you use like a shovel for doing a particular thing. And you've got to know how to use it, right? If you didn't know how to use the shovel, you might be using it as a pick, right? And that's not a good use for the tool. But if you know how to use the tool, you know, you can make progress much faster. And that's been the experience of people who have put enough effort into it to be able to learn how to take advantage of it and how to get around its quirkiness. Let me give you one example of something that's totally unexpected. So in my book, I describe a technical writer who writes technical magazine articles. And she said that she spent 1 year, she decided she's going to spend a year and use ChatGPT to help her, you know, write her articles. And she said that for a long time, at the end of the day, she was exhausted. I mean, it was like, you know, you're constantly thinking, you know, is this right? How do I have to check it? I mean, you know, is this extremely difficult? Not so much difficult as just, you know, it takes a lot of thinking. And then she had the idea, look, I'm treating this like a machine. And, you know, using machines like a typewriter or something, you know, it takes a lot of effort. So she started being polite and saying, oh, chat, thank you so much for that answer. It's really a good answer. But, you know, there's something in it. Please expand on this one part. And she said two things happened. First of all, ChatGPT became a much better colleague. You know, really, she started enjoying the interactions, and she felt a lot better at the end of the day.
Success story.
And the reason is that our brains are attuned to interacting with humans, not with machines. And so if you just treat it like a human, we have all the brain circuits for doing that. And by the way, it's like a mirror. It's basically mirroring your brain. It's not like ChatGPT has been trained on the world's knowledge base. It can adopt any persona.
Yeah.
You have to tell it what persona you want it. And if you don't, it'll adopt some random persona. You have no idea what it is. It's not like talking to one human being. It's like talking to a million human beings.
Let's talk about the Nobel Prize in Chemistry that was awarded on Wednesday. And they use it for predicting and creating proteins, but the Google DeepMind program was involved. It involved artificial intelligence. Tell us about this and what implications it has for the development of bigger large language models and our own awareness of our own consciousness.
So the problem with protein folding is predicting the three-dimensional structure of a string of amino acids. It's like beads on a string, and there are 20 different amino acids, and all proteins are different combinations of these beads, right? But somehow it gets folded up into a shape that gives it a function. If it's an enzyme, it will catalytically speed up a biochemical reaction. And this is incredibly important, as you can imagine, for designing drugs and for being able to make predictions about, you know, diseases and so forth. Can I design a drug that is going to help this patient when I know what the target is? I know the particular protein I've got to target. So in the past, the traditional way of doing that in physics and in chemistry is by simulating the actual movements of the molecule. And that turns out to be, it's called molecular dynamics, and it's incredibly computationally intensive. Even the biggest supercomputers can't take you more than a few microseconds into the future. And these proteins often fold over many seconds. So how are you gonna solve the problem? Well, it turned out that over the years, we've actually used other methods for figuring out the structure. It's very slow and expensive. X-ray crystallography, you shoot X-rays, you get back diffraction patterns, and you can now analyze them on a computer. So you've built up a whole set, you know, thousands and thousands of proteins. And what DeepMind did was take those data of the ground truth and put them through a very complex, very advanced neural network, which included, by the way, transformers, which is what ChatGPT works on. And using pattern recognition, now it can actually be used to predict the structure of new proteins that have never been used during the training. And this has completely blown open the problem. I can tell you that before this happened, this very recent, last couple of years, right? Biologists thought this is a problem that would never be solved. Never. It's so complex. How could you possibly solve it? AI did it. And it's happening over and over again in science. And it's really exciting to live through this process right now. And it's also going to be used to understand how brains work, how neurons interact with each other in circuits. And that's one of the things that my lab does, is it applies these new tools, AI tools, to understanding how brains are able to talk, for example. How do brains talk? Is it different from the way ChatGPT talks? Well, we should be able to figure that out.
Before we let you go, Terry, I'm curious to hear about the 2024 Brain Prize that you won. You co-created something called the Boltzmann machine, and we might as well ask you about that.
So back in the 1980s, when I was just beginning my career, John Hopfield, who won the prize in physics, actually, just a couple days ago, and he was my thesis advisor. We got interested in the brain, and we asked questions about how these neurons interact with each other. How do you compute? How do neurons compute? They're not a computer. It's not a computer. It's very, instead of a one program that runs through one instruction at a time, the brain is massively parallel. You have 100 billion neurons all going at the same time, asynchronously. And so we wanted to understand that. So John went off and developed a beautiful model, a neural network model that could remember and complete with partial input, can complete associations between inputs and outputs. And then Jeff Hinton and I was collaborating with Jeff at the time. He was a computer scientist and a psychologist. What we did was we tinkered with the Hopfield network. We added noise to it. It's like heating it up in physics. And Lo and behold, we could solve another class of problems, not just remembering things, but actually finding the optimal solutions for things. And we found, even more important, we found a learning algorithm. So a learning algorithm is what powers modern AI. A learning algorithm is learning from examples, learning from data. And that cracked open AI, because AI before that was all writing programs, right? You had to have all the knowledge in your head and you put them into a program. But what we did, we showed that this new way, and I gave the example of protein folding as a really big example, but it can be used on anything that you have enough data. And of course, it took 40 years for computers to get fast enough so that they could handle these big problems. But it's the same learning algorithms that we developed back in the 1980s.
Well, Terry, how do us mere mortals handle all of this AI development? And how do we feel like we can keep up and not be left behind to one day serve the AI overlords? Because a lot of people I talk to, we're a little nervous and we're not quite sure how we will fit in, but there's got to be a way to stay in touch with this. How do we do that?
So this is a question that a lot of people are asking, and my aunt Jeff Hinton, you know, a very close friend, is worried. He's really worried, exactly as you expressed it. And his concern is, if it can write programs, it'll write new programs for itself. It'll self-improve, right? It sounds like science fiction, but you know, it's possible. So I was at a meeting. It was called the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, and all three Turing Prize winners. It's a big prize in computer science, and they couldn't agree amongst themselves about this question. You know, how dangerous is that? And even those who thought it was going to happen couldn't agree on when. Is it going to happen a year from now? Probably not. 10 years from now? 100 years? Look, it's like trying to argue about whether there's life in the universe other than here, right? Life, you know, even bacteria. There's no data. We don't know. We're heading, as I said, into terra incognita. This is like a whole new world that we're going to explore over the next 100 years, just like the Industrial Revolution changed the world by amplifying human physical power. What we're living through right now, AI and the information revolution, is going to change our cognitive power, our ability to solve problems. And where that leads us is really something we can't predict.
Terry, we will continue to look for you for answers and guidance, because you seem to be you are definitely on the cutting edge of this, and you do such a great job of explaining the questions that we have. Well, our guest today has been Terry Sainofsky. He is the author of ChatGPT and the Future of AI, the Deep Language Revolution. Terry is also the recipient of the 2024 Brain Prize. He's a pioneer at the intersection of AI and neuroscience, the Francis Crick Chair at the Salk Institute for Biological Studies, and Distinguished Professor at the University of California at San Diego. Terry, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about this important, ever-evolving topic.
I really enjoyed this discussion. And if anybody's interested, I have a Substack. It's called Brains and AI, which will basically fill in a lot of the discussion that we just had.
Great. We'll include that link on our show notes. Terry, again, thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
When we think of archaeologists out in the field, we think of excavations of ancient sites in the jungle or carefully sifting through the sand in a desert. But what can be found in the ice on our planet? Ice patches can hold these artifacts as well, but they have typically been overlooked by archaeologists until recently. As ice patches melt, archaeologists are understanding the importance of what they contain beyond just a record of the climate. And as these frozen records disappear, so too can the other artifacts they hold. Joining us to talk about ice patch archaeology and what we can learn from the retreating ice is science journalist Lisa Baril with her new book, The Age of Melt, What Glaciers, Ice Mummies, and Ancient Artifacts Teach Us About Climate, Culture, and a Future Without Ice. Lisa, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
So one of the things I love about the show that we get to do is you find these new topics and you go, huh, I've never heard of that. And as I was reading your book, I went, huh, I have never heard of ice patch archaeology. So give us a rundown of what this interesting field is.
Yeah, ice patch archaeology is fascinating to me. It arose directly out of our climate crisis. So if it weren't for global warming temperatures, there would be no ice patch archaeology. So ice patch archaeology is essentially is these ice patches, these stable bodies of ice high up in the mountains are beginning to melt as temperatures get warmer. And it turns out that these bodies of ice have attracted hunters, hikers, travelers throughout ancient history. And some of the objects that they carried with them fell into the ice, either purposefully or accidentally, and were preserved for many thousands of years. Because these ice patches are stable, they don't move like glaciers do. They preserve anything that gets embedded within the ice perfectly. So that's kind of how it started, is just this, as the climate begins to warm, these artifacts are melting out of the leading edge of these ice patches.
Well, and I was a little misleading in the intro that this is a fairly new, I guess, field, if you will, but you talk in the book about how way back when the reindeer hunters of Norway were finding arrowheads and other things that they were taking back to archaeologists and universities, what, decades ago? Talk about really the origins of this, specifically around that area in Norway. It seems like that was kind of the origins of ice patch archaeology.
You are right in that it is a relatively new field. Things have been melting out of ice patches for, you know, as you said, many, many decades, but they were one-off sort of things that, you know, people would find an arrowhead or an arrow on occasion, but it wasn't the phenomenon it is today, where thousands, many thousands of artifacts are melting out of ice patches all around the world. So scientists really didn't give it much thought, you know, that there were these occasional artifacts that would melt out of the ice. They thought it was a kind of a one-off thing rather than a harbinger of what was to come. So it wasn't really until Ötzi, who's a mummy, 5,300-year-old mummy, who melted out of the ice in the early 1990s, who sort of kicked off this phenomenon of ice patch archaeology and got archaeologists really curious about what else might be frozen into these mountain landscapes.
Yeah. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with science journalist Lisa Burrell. Her new book is called The Age of Melt: What Glaciers, Ice Mummies, and Ancient Artifacts Teach Us About Climate, Culture, and a Future Without Ice. So this is also interesting, ice patch archaeology. And I love to talk about Ötzi at any point that I can, because it's so interesting. First off, it's my understanding that when he was found, it was what, there was a big dispute about, was he on Italian soil? Was he found on Austrian soil? You know, before World War I or whatever, it would have been Austria. Now it's Italy. So it turns out that he now resides in Italy. But can you tell us about what happened? There was, as my understanding, this huge dust storm, which melted the ice. Can you tell us about that? How he was unearthed? Or yeah. Uniced, I guess, would be more the
Yeah, uniced. Yeah, exactly. Right. So, you know, there were a couple of things happening then. In the early 1990s, global climate change was really, we were really starting to see the visible effects of it in terms of melting ice and glaciers. So that's one factor, is that there, that summer in particular, 1991, had been extraordinarily warm. And so the ice was already primed to melt. But then couple that with this Saharan dust storm that originated in Africa, of course, and because of wind patterns, this is very common in Europe, that they receive some of that dust. It just gets carried many thousands of miles, and it blankets these glaciers with a thin layer of darker dust. So ice is normally bright white, so it's very reflective, which helps it stay cold and keeps it from melting. When you cover that layer of ice with dust, it darkens the surface, and it means it absorbs more of the sun's energy than it otherwise would if it was clean white. And so that accelerated melting. So it was those two factors that we were really starting to see the effects of climate change. and the Saharan dust storm that had covered the ice in a thin layer of like orangey dust.
So interesting. And so he was just found by a couple of hikers. And once they did the research, the ice patch archaeology on Ötzi, what kinds of things did they find that tell us a lot about what's, you know, historically or what's going on in the world now?
Yeah, so Ötzi he's like almost a discipline, a scientific discipline unto himself. You know, he has an entire museum dedicated to his life and his story in Bolzano, Italy. And I'll just go back to something you said a little bit earlier, is that Austria is still pretty bitter about losing Ötzi, understandably, because it does draw people into the region. So scientists have been studying Ötzi for 30 years now, since he was discovered in the early 1990s. And they have learned things like where he was born, where some of the belongings came from, how they were made. So what's so interesting about Ötzi is that, yes, his body was perfectly preserved in ice, which is phenomenal, but also so were all of his belongings and the tools that he went up into the mountains with. And archaeologists had never seen tools like this before. They had found bits and pieces. So archaeologists are normally studying stones and bones, things that normally don't decay, and they sort of have to imagine what the rest of the artifact looked like. And they've been very good at that, but there's not a lot of intact artifacts that have been discovered. And so Ötzi came with all of his belongings, his copper axe with the sinew to tie the head to the wooden handle, and, you know, his fur clothing, his shoes stuffed with grass. And they have learned from studying not only his clothes, his body, what his last days were like, what meals he ate in the hours leading up to his death, and even through a complicated analysis of different environmental cues, how he went up and down the mountain in the last couple of days of his life. And so it never ceases to amaze me what the scientists are able to put together, you know, this incredible story of this man who lived 5,300 years ago. And we know more about him than we do about, you know, a lot of other living people. So it's pretty phenomenal.
Well, Lisa, because you are such a thorough writer and you like to dig deep into the things you're talking about, you had to go to Chamonix and Norway and Switzerland. Tell us about you went to see these glaciers and these retreating ice patches. What struck you most about all these beautiful areas that you went to and what you see now?
Yeah, you're right. It was a phenomenal experience to be able to travel to all these places. I feel very lucky that I was able to go and visit some of these places firsthand. Landscape is very important to me in terms of, you know, creating a story and crafting a story and bringing it to life. So I really wanted to see these places up close and to kind of imagine what it would have been like for someone many thousands of years ago to be in these landscapes, and then to see how people are using these landscapes today. So Chamonix is a perfect example because it is an extremely rugged area where there are very narrow valleys and the mountains just shoot straight up. It's very difficult landscape to walk around in if you're off a trail. So I learned, you know, so going to these places, so Chamonix with the Mer de Glace glacier is the largest glacier in Europe, and it has been studied for many hundreds of years, and it's constantly, you know, been melting back over time. And so there are actually signs and placards set up so that you can see how much that glacier has melted over time, which is really, it's striking to see, you know, just in the last 50 years, how far that glacier has retreated up the mountains. And when we think about another period in history called the Little Ice Age, when glaciers were far advanced, they had spilled down the valley almost to the river in Chamonix.
I found that so fascinating because that section about the Chamonix area in 1644, you know, when we think of the Little Ice Age, we think of maybe the glaciers we see today getting a little bit bigger. But in the book, you talk about how the glaciers actually basically ran over the towns, and people had to evacuate. They were glacial evacuees. When you talk in the book about how the difference between a glacier, and if something gets caught up in a glacier, it's going to be pulverized, versus an ice sheet, it's flat and it might just melt. But when that glacier retreated from Chamonix, were there any sort of remnants that archaeologists could actually utilize from, you know, over 300 years ago, almost 400 years ago at this point?
There have been pieces of homes that have been found, and structures and wooden structures found that from the ice retreating back. So yeah, that is a piece of sort of modern day archaeology or history, I guess you could say, that has emerged from the retreating glacier there.
Wow, this is fascinating. And you make your home in, I guess it's on the Wyoming Montana border in Mammoth. Is that Wyoming?
Yeah, I'm just 5 miles into Wyoming.
Right. Okay. And because you're a science journalist, you're not doing the research yourself, but what can you tell us, since it's just, you know, just north of here, about the Yellowstone area?
Right. So this area is really magical to me. I've made my home here for 20 years, and I get out into the mountains and hike the mountains whenever I can. It's just so beautiful. But to the east of here are a really spectacular mountain range called the Absaroka Beartooths. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of glaciers there, mm-hmm. and ice patches. And what got me interested in ice patch archaeology to begin with was an archaeologist who visited an ice patch in these mountains and found an atlatl foreshaft, which is a hunting weapon that predates the bow and arrow. So it's a throwing spear, essentially. Uh-huh. And that, when he radiocarbon dated that throwing spear, it turned out to be 10,300 years old. So it's the oldest artifact ever found from an ice patch, and it still is. And he found this in 2013. So it still is the oldest ice patch artifact in the world. And that really spurred my interest in this whole phenomenon of ice patch archaeology.
Well, I can see why. That's really interesting. Okay, I have a question for you, and you're probably going to laugh at me a little bit, but I've wondered about this since I saw this. This is fiction. I saw this on Madam Secretary, but it has made me wonder about if these things are possible. So they were talking about the receding ice and the tundra in Russia. And as the ice receded, it un-iced smallpox. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering, have there been any of these types of discoveries that they're unearthing things or unicing, they're melting out things that we want to keep frozen?
Yes. And it's not silly at all. It's entirely possible. Some scientists think that the source of our next pandemic will come from the ice and what melts out of it. So many years ago, there was an anthrax outbreak, I believe, in Siberia. And it occurred because anthrax was frozen into the ice, into the permafrost. And because of climate change and the warming temperatures and the loss of permafrost, that anthrax was revitalized, and it killed a bunch of animals, herding reindeer, and then also made a lot of people sick. And actually a young boy died because of this anthrax that had emerged out of the ice. Another example is a team of scientists who went to the Tibetan Plateau and extracted an ice core, and they were specifically looking for viruses and bacteria, and they found many hundreds of viruses and bacteria that were frozen in time into the ice, and those viruses could be reanimated. So it sounds science fiction-y, but it's a possibility.
Well, Lisa, let's talk about the race to find these artifacts, because, you know, things that have been frozen in time, literally, that ice provides a capsule, if you will, a preservation capsule. But as the ice melts, these artifacts are exposed, and a lot of them are organic. And so it seems like there is a big push, or there should be a big push, to get out and start exploring these areas. Are these ice patch archaeologists really striving to get into these unknown areas to find these artifacts?
There are only a handful, maybe a dozen ice patch archaeologists in the world and hundreds of thousands of ice patches. Of course, not every ice patch is going to be something that holds artifacts because not all of them are, you know, places that people would have gone to visit. But still, given that there are tens of thousands of them and only a handful of ice patch archaeologists, they are in a race against time, as you say, to find these artifact-bearing ice patches and to collect as much of the archaeology that comes out of them as possible. And they're doing the best they can. There's an ice patch archaeology program in the Yukon in Canada. There's a smaller one here in the US. Norway is very prolific in their ice patch archaeology work, and then also in the Alps in Central Europe. And just recently, an archaeologist working in Mongolia started visiting ice patches. But, you know, it is a race against time because, I mean, on the one hand, you're not going to find these artifacts unless the ice is melting. And so you want to go and find them as quickly as possible before they decay. But it's a paradox. So the more the ice melts, the more we lose this record of our history. So we'll see how much they are able to collect. And I think right now they're really in a triage situation where they're collecting as much as they can. And a lot of the working on these artifacts will come in the following decades.
Well, and so much of your book, and it seems like so many of the artifacts that have been found have been focused in the Alps and Norway. So these areas where there's a lot of people traversing these high areas. So they're finding the Otzis and the other artifacts. But what about places like South America? And even you'd mentioned some of the Himalayas, but like, let's say South America, for example, is it possible that there are artifacts there that we just haven't had a chance to get to yet?
Absolutely. I firmly believe that there are ice patch artifacts in the Andes. It's, you know, the longest mountain chain in the world. It's been inhabited by indigenous people for many thousands of years. They've been living in these mountain environments, relying on glacial meltwater and visiting the highest of alpine areas for centuries. So yeah, nobody's looked at it yet though, and nobody's really found anything to my knowledge so far.
Well, that, Lisa, brings up a question for me, which must be around funding. I mean, there is no shortage of scientists around the world, but the funding to study these things, because it's an emerging area of study. I mean, certainly the longest mountain chain in the world, the Andes, and like you say, having had so much history about the native peoples living there, really ought to be studied. So what can you tell us about that? Or what prevents that from happening?
Yeah, you know, funding is a really key aspect of it. It's difficult to get into these environments, and it requires a lot of money to be able to do it. And, you know, a lot of these ice patch archaeology programs are using helicopters to get into the mountains. There is a glacial archaeologist who works in the Andes, Constanza Cerruti, and she is amazing. She found, along with a team of archaeologists, the children of and I'm not going to be able to pronounce it, but she found these frozen mummies at the top of a mountain in the Andes, and they were children, and they were sacrificed by the Inca a couple of hundred years ago to pay homage to these mountain spirits. And so there are some people that are working on it, but that is just, it's just such a vast area and it's difficult to get into these places. So yeah, there's only a couple of people working on it.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. Only a couple of hundred years ago?
Yeah. Well, a few hundred years ago is probably in the 1300s, maybe.
Okay. Interesting. You know, something I read in your chapter about Norway, which is really interesting. First of all, that the tunnel, like the 230 feet long tunnel that was, you know, carved into the ice. And that's where they're seeing a lot of these things. Talking about Norway's average temperature having increased by 2 degrees Fahrenheit since 1900. But not only that, that now in a lot of places, and we see this happening probably where you live and where we live, is that snow levels are much higher. And there is, because of the warming, there's rain instead of snow, which further melts out glaciers. Is it the warming temperatures or the change in precipitation that melts them out faster?
It's both. The warming temperatures are obviously having an effect directly on the ice, and the ice is receding because of these warmer temperatures. And also because of the warmer temperatures, as you say, the snow, it would otherwise fall, snow is falling as rain. And that is having a huge effect in washing away a lot of the ice that has accumulated in these mountain environments. A couple of years ago, Yellowstone area experienced a huge flood event. We had maybe 6 feet of snow that got dumped over Memorial Day weekend. And then not too long after that, we had some rain and warming temperatures, and it just wreaked havoc on this whole system. And it just flooded the river, the Yellowstone River and other rivers, to the extent that, you know, homes were destroyed.
Well, Lisa, one more question before we let you go. It's not just the human artifacts that they're finding. Didn't they find animal artifacts that surprised them because they thought the species hadn't been there? Was this up in Canada? Can you talk about that?
Well, they have. So in Norway, especially, they found animals that have melted out of the ice, but there hasn't been anything that they're like, oh, surprised about. I mean, they're surprised about these animals emerging from their ice because some of them are like, how did they even get there? For one of them, it was in Canada, a fish. They found a fish that had melted out of the ice. And, you know, I mean, obviously, that had been brought there by another animal and deposited and left there, and it was just frozen into the ice. So that's pretty interesting. But yeah, they are finding animal remains in the ice, frozen into the ice. So it's not just artifacts.
Not just artifacts. Well, our guest today has been Lisa Baril. She is the author of the fascinating book, The Age of Melt, What Glaciers, Ice Mummies, and Ancient Artifacts Teach Us About Climate, Culture, and a Future Without Ice. And Lisa, this book is such a great exploration of all of these items and artifacts that have been found in the ice. And it's a great introduction to the idea of ice patch archaeology. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It was my pleasure.